Graduation is a sweet occasion, but finding the perfect gift can be a bitter struggle. MMS.com has a solution. Personalized M&Ms. Just imagine the look on your grad's face when they receive a custom candy creation featuring their school's colors, name, and even their photo printed right on some M&Ms. It's a thoughtful way to celebrate their accomplishments and make the occasion even more special. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code WONDERY to receive 15% off your next order.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code WONDERY for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code WONDERY.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 441. This episode is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock, you're going to find the perfect video for your next creative project. You can choose from over 700,000 high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, 3D motion graphics, and a variety of digital formats. Most of them come in HD. That's high definition, Katie.
Thanks.
That means high def. You know, sometimes I'll say high definition. Sometimes I'll say HD. Sometimes I'll say high def.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll say high D. Sometimes I'll say high definition, just to mix it up a little bit. They add 10,000 video clips each week, so every time you visit, you're going to find something new. They're going to give you the assets that you need to bring your creative projects to the next level, and they're going to make it super easy. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account. Start using it. Imagine what your next project's going to be like. Save your video selections you find in your clip box. And then when you decide, use the offer code NERDIST11. It changes every time. It changes. So now it's NERDIST11, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com for 30% off new accounts. Use the offer code NERDIST11. I'm going to be doing some stand-up on the road in December, 6th, 7th, and 13th. I'll be in Minneapolis, Chicago, and Seattle. So go to Nerdist.com/calendar for info on...
With me, Matt Myra.
Oh, Matt. That's...
Poor Matt's not even here to defend himself.
I know. The worst part about it was, like, I was like, what would be if, like, I were to be the guy that tried to do a Matt impression to be mean, but then did a really bad job at it?
You know, 10 seconds before you did it, you made this face like you were trying to fart. You just made this face where you're like, what's he doing? And then all of a sudden, I'm Matt Myra.
And it wasn't like, it's not, the joke that I did isn't to make fun of Matt Myra, it was to make fun of a guy trying to just be mean for no reason.
Oh, poor little rhubarb.
No, you're taking it the wrong way. It was about a guy.
Well, he's going to be taking it the wrong way.
No, I'll tell him about it. I tell everything to his stupid face. I like the idea that a guy, like, you know, that just... is mean when the person's not around. I just, never mind.
Well, I love, this semi-hostful intro has been controversial because this episode is Oliver Stone. And I was very nervous about the Oliver Stone episode because he's a guy that is essentially a machine of names and dates and events. I'm not a historian, so I have no recourse to be like, no, that was not, in fact, the Warren Commission, you know, like, and so I was very nervous because I would imagine that he probably expect, this one was, I feel like, much more of an interviewee. Mm-hmm. Normally these podcasts are more like, you know, conversations and, oh, like, you know, it's like a phone conversation.
Yeah.
But this I felt like was more interviewee because he, you know, he had a lot to say that. The Untold History of the United States is the documentary, this 12-part documentary series that he did that's on Showtime and it's on Amazon and iTunes. And then the JFK 50-year commemorative, commemorating the 50 years since the assassination, the ultimate Blu-ray edition of JFK is out too. And it's really cool. They sent me one. I gave it to Matt Myra because I saw drool like when he was like, oh, did you get one of those collector's editions? I'm like, here you go. But it's got a lot of cool extra stuff in it. So this was a very interesting podcast for me because I tend to stay away from politics on the podcast because I sort of feel like, A, I'm not a historian and I'm not a hardcore political comedian at all, not even a softcore political comedian. But, you know, I like everything on the podcast to sort of feel uplifting, and I like the podcast to sort of, you know, make people feel unified, and I feel like politics divides people. So this was an interesting podcast for me because I think you'll find that I'm not editorializing on anything. I'm essentially just asking questions and listening. So this was relatively unique in that way. Whether you agree with everything the guy says or not, like, he definitely, he's a smart guy.
Yeah,
and
that
he
show
definitely
was great.
He definitely does. Did you watch the whole series?
I've watched three of the episodes.
Yeah.
Of Untold History.
I've seen them all. It's great.
Yeah. I'm starting to feel bad that we're trying to misconstrue the joke I did earlier. I think we should just cut it out.
No, I'm going to leave it in.
No,
I played into it too, so there was a second shooter.
There was.
Yay!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Oliver Stone, thank you for being here on the podcast.
Nice to see you, Chris.
I wasn't sure I would ever say those words out loud. Oliver Stone, thank you for being on the podcast.
I don't know what I'm on, but I'll play attention as I go.
It's like a digital radio wonderland.
That sounds good.
And I said before, I actually made notes, and I never make notes for people.
It indicates an organizing principle behind your society.
There is a little bit of an organizing principle. I haven't figured out what that is yet or what my motivations are, but I just don't want to look like I don't want to look like a fucking idiot.
You know what the organizing principle of our society is?
What
American
is that?
Society is war.
I guess that is a huge part of it. There is no war here. You and I are in peace.
No, we are different kinds of people. We exist as fringe people inside this state of warfare.
Yes. Yeah, so we're those types of cogs in that. What are you trying to say, Monica? Come in. You're holding up a note in the window. I can't see that far away.
No decaf, Monica?
Oh, Kyle has a decaf.
Oh.
What are you looking? What do you need?
No.
I was thinking of something.
You need Katie? Make sure Kyle is getting Mr. Stone's decaf coffee.
Okay.
All right.
Sure, Monica.
Thanks, Mom.
And then come in here. Please sit down. She should join the conversation.
She really should, actually, because she's actually a Marine Reserve. She's a Marine Reserve.
Terrific. I like her.
And
already.
So, happy Veterans Day to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank
it's
you for your service
you
to our country.
Thank you.
I'm sure a lot of people know, but you received the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart.
Thank you.
For your service in Vietnam.
Yeah. And I have to say, that it's led me onto many fields of thought.
Well, you know, I don't know if people know that you spent, what, a year at Yale? You went to Yale for a year, and then you dropped out to go teach school in South Vietnam.
More or less, yes. I went. Yes, that's true. I went to Yale for that first freshman year. And once you dropped out, stayed in Vietnam for the whole year practically, and taught in school and taught English, mathematics, history to high school students in Cholon, and then joined the Merchant Marine. I became a wiper because you could join the Merchant Marine. It was a unionized activity, but you could join it abroad and replace a seaman that was missing in action somewhere out there. So I sailed around, and then I eventually came back to the States. It was an extraordinary voyage, Northern Pacific in winter. It was amazing. Back to Oregon, Coos Bay, Oregon, from Saigon.
So, obviously...
Almost died on that trip.
Oh, you did? What happened?
Well, the ship was coming back light. All the ships used to go over to Vietnam were taking heavy goods to Vietnam. Arms, food supplies, PX, television sets, cars. We were building up Vegas in Vietnam. And they would all come back light. A lot of them would come back with nothing. So we had no ballast in the ship. And we hit the storms of the Northern Pacific, which are extraordinary, by the way. Something to be seen, to be believed. And I remember the ship, it was an old Liberty, was pitching like 44 degrees. One night we went over 44 degrees. A 45-degree tilt is about it. You go over. We almost capsized. All the dishes were broken. I'll never forget the fear of that night and seeing the water coming through my porthole practically.
But you, are you the type of person that is the next day you're like, oh, we got through that?
Oh, no. This was like a Lord Jim kind of experience because all these guys in the Merchant Marine were rugged guys, veterans, but strange people. They all had strange lives and had been in Africa and the romance run in Latin America. They had wives in the States, many of them, but they never seemed to have lasting marriages or families. They were, there was a call of the sea. You always you bitched about the sea, but you'd always come back. back eventually. They always had that law that you return to the sea. So many of them, you know, were lonely men in a sense, but always interesting to talk to, eccentric stories. Some of them told me they were CIA agents in Korea. They had amazing, and you know, half of it's true probably. Half of it was true. I was at the Kennedy assassination for all I know.
And you don't know if they're telling it, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes they were that way, you know. I'm saying with the sea, you never know if the tales are quite true.
Does the sea forgive all? Like, is it a good place for people to go to escape what's going on land?
Well, it's a place where people with problems go to. You know, you realize that it's not a stable existence. Now they have container ships, of course, and they use mostly foreign crews, but it was an amazing experience as a young man to go through that. I love the ocean. I love sailing. And I was a wiper, which is the lowest job on the ship. I mean, I had to clean all the engine room, all the toilets. It was a rough job, too, because I had boiling oil fall on me through parts of the day. I had to blow the tubes. I don't know anyone in your audience is going, they're young people. They're not going to know what that means. Blowing the tubes is when you have to clean out the boiler every day.
Yeah, a lot of my generation doesn't know how to do things with their hands. If there is an apocalypse, a lot of us are completely fucked because we know how to work computers.
Well, now it's computerized.
Now it's all computerized, yeah. But so what did it feel like, like the political climate at the time, and then where essentially so much of society was clashing with what was going on politically? Did you feel particularly charged by the energy, and is that why you wanted to go teach in South Vietnam, or what was it that what did you feel at the time?
I knew is what I didn't like. I knew that I did not belong with the Yale crowd. I'd gone there from boarding school, and I was in George Bush's class at Yale. He was a class of '68. And I just knew I didn't belong. I didn't fit in. So I had to find my way in the world. And I'd read a lot of Conrad and Hemingway and stuff like that. And I believed in, I guess, the male thing about finding yourself, proving yourself. So I went out there to do that. And I came back, and I went back to Yale for half a semester. I wrote a book I dropped out again. I was writing a book about my adventures, which became A Child's Night Dream, which was published in 1995, eventually by St. Martin's Press. There's an interesting chapter on the Merchant Marine. But basically, I went back to Yale and dropped out again and wrote and wrote and wrote. And then when that book was rejected in early 67, I went back into I volunteered for the draft, and I went back to Vietnam because I think I had to get one step further and go to the bottom of the barrel, so to speak, and see if I would come out alive on the other side. So I wanted to see war. And I got my fill of it. I arrived in September of 67 after Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and I was in the infantry for 15 months.
Was your desire to see war as a soldier, or to see war as an artist as well, to see what it...
I guess I had an artistic temperament. Yes, I guess I had an artistic temperament, and I wanted to see, experience war. I had been influenced, as I said, by Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls, by, and you get these images, and they become locked in your brain, and you want to... I guess every young man, to a certain degree, whether it's football or sports, wants to prove that he's a man, you know. I can't say what happened over there. It was, I came back from the war very alienated, very numbed out, drugged out too. And it took me a while to get back into society. It took me about a year to fit in, to start to get socialized, to talk to people in a normal way again. I just didn't have that capacity, and I ended up, thank God, at NYU Film School under the GI Bill, and I was able to integrate my life back together through making short films. I mean, it was stumbling at first. I finally found my way, and after film school, I graduated to be a cab driver, a messenger, various jobs, all kinds of work in New York City, typing pools. God almighty, I was an assistant on a porno film, anything to work. And I wrote scripts all the time, kept writing scripts, and eventually I got lucky. And 1979 was a bit breakthrough year with Midnight Express.
Mm-hmm.
And
Al Parker.
I went from zero to the heights right away. I won an Academy Award. That's not very good for you because you're not used to it. And then I went down again and up again and down again. My career has been up and down ever since.
Do you feel like that anything you learned in the military or any of the time you spent overseas, did it teach you any values? Did it teach you any skill sets that you were able to sort of transform?
As a GI, no. You don't have any skill sets except how to handle yourself in combat, which is a rare experience on the domestic front. But I think you do have a sense of an experience, a discipline, a sense of a group, and you see the world perhaps more clearly, because combat and infantry and the war itself, the military, is a huge machine, and it grinds up men, it grinds up money, and there's a tremendous amount of waste in war. I hope you realize how much there is, and things get done that are very cruel and unusual. And I think because of that experience, I'm able to see things in government life that are excessive and cruel and unusual and unnecessary. And whenever we go back to wars, I think I'm able to see through the talk, because it's always the chicken hawks, the backdoor patriots, you know, the guys who are always out there on Memorial Day, you know, yelling about how great this country is, who are the worst. People who say this is the greatest country in the world, they're not paying attention. And you see it everywhere in this country now. You see more and more false patriotism. It's disgusting to me. I think it's the last refuge of scoundrels, as they used to say.
So what do you believe true patriotism is?
Love of country. Love of country. That is to make your country a better place, to try to help it, to, when you see things that are wrong, to criticize and to try to fix them, not to pave them over with more money and more sugar like they used to do in the military.
Well, I think I watched part of your series, The Untold History of the United States. Katie, go see where Kyle is.
Yeah, this is a coffee. You said this is a coffee clutch, and you don't have any coffee. You know.
Kyle has a beard. Grab him by the beard and yank him down and punch him in the face.
Cheapos you are.
Yeah, no, seriously. This is bullshit.
Anyway, we're talking...
Oh, here he is. Kyle's here.
We haven't talked about my movies, goddammit.
We're going to talk about your movies. We're going to talk about all...
We're wasting time talking about the man.
Yeah, we're going to talk...
Behind the movies.
Well...
You're the other guy here?
No, Kyle's just taking notes. Kyle's taking notes.
Are you another provocateur?
I am.
Good.
Kyle looks like a Muppet. He's got the...
Can you get Monica in here? I want to talk to her about military.
Yeah.
She could, yeah.
Make it fun.
I watched the JFK episode of the Untold History.
Good.
And what I found to be interesting was seeing... your portrayal in the documentary of Khrushchev and Kennedy as something that I hadn't really seen before, though admittedly I have not watched every documentary, but the idea that when they were faced with war, that they both changed and went, wait a minute, maybe this is a bad idea.
Monica.
I think he wants you to come sit over here.
Oh my goodness, no, I just wanted to listen in.
I told him you were in the Marines.
Yeah, he got my respect.
And so he wanted to...
Really, you made the Korean Marines? You survived?
No, she's in the American Marines.
No, sir, I'm
not. Oh.
She's Korean, but she's in the American
Marines. Korean Marines are much tougher.
They're pretty intense. Yeah. I got to train with a couple of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, twice a year Monica has to go overseas and she disappears for like a month.
Oh, really? Oh, she's still in it.
Yeah. She still has to go. How many times do you go twice a year?
Twice a year, I lump it all into one. It's a particular reserve.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I go to Korea.
The Korean soldiers were always the roughest in Vietnam. They were hated by the Vietnamese because they messed with them quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah, they were very cruel. But we're going back to Khrushchev and Kennedy for a moment. It was an extraordinary moment, the nuclear crisis of October 62. The world was really at the edge because we didn't know that the Russians had 40,000 tough troops there, led by the commander of Stalingrad, the commander of that fought that great battle in World War II. They had 100 nuclear battlefield weapons. That is what we didn't know. The Cubans had more men than we thought they did. They were 250,000 well-armed men. And they had different styles of missiles than we even knew of. We knew part of what they had. So we would have gone in there thinking we were going to take 20,000 casualties. But McNamara, years later, when he found out what the Russians really had, said we would have taken 100,000 casualties. And it would have been like, with the paranoia of those times, and the Joint Chiefs wanted a war with the Soviets because they knew that they could lick the Soviets. We had almost a 10-to-1 parity. We were much stronger than the Soviets at that time. They knew that we could take out the Soviet Union in 1960 and get away with it without significant retaliation. That was the basis of the movie that Strangelove, that Kubrick did. You know, they talk about what the retaliation factors would be. How many people do you lose? And the Joint Chiefs were saying, you know, if we wait, the Soviets are going to build up and they're going to achieve parity, which they did by the 1970s, almost parity. Reagan then made it worse than it was. He talked about another big gap, and he got into office in 1980 on that basis. But really, there was a significant moment in our history when we were ready for war again. We'd waited since 1945, remember? We dropped two atomic bombs on Japan. We didn't need to. We did it. It was a very barbaric act. We can go back and talk about that. But we're ready to use nukes. We'd built up, with Eisenhower, to 30,000 nuclear weapons. 30,000 nuclear weapons. We have about 7,000 now. We had 30,000. When you build that kind of machinery, you want to go, you know. It's like you build a bomb, you want to drop it. You want to see if it works, you know. So I'm saying there was a tremendous kind of feeling in the air by 1960 that we were going to have crises after crises with the Soviet Union, whether it was Formosa, whether it was Suez, or whether it was going to be Berlin again, because Berlin had been a significant crisis point. By 1962, this with Cuba, 90 miles off our shores, we hit that point. We're ready to go. That's what Kennedy was facing. The hardliners wanted him to drop those weapons, wanted to invade and fight. And we were on the edge, on trigger. We were on DEFCON 2 for about 20 days or whatever it was, DEFCON 2, which was not declared by Kennedy. It was declared by the Air Force general, who did it on his own, because under Eisenhower's policy, commanders had the right to go to nuclear postures on their own accord. So there was a guy named Thomas Power who was in charge of the Air Force. He went to DEFCON 2. And we almost had, near accidents. There was a nuclear submarine, a Russian nuclear submarine. We went into that one.
Yes, that I did not know about. That I did not know about. I wrote the guy's name down. Vasily Arkhipov?
Yeah, Arkhipov. Yeah, it's a great character, and it's a great story. It's a great story. He stopped this thing. The Russian commander was ready to fire because he had been depth charged, and he was outside the quarantine line, and he assumed that the war had broken out. And he said they knew they were basically fucked. They were going to die. So he said, let's at least go out with some, and fire off. And she would have fired, and then it would have been one thing after the other. Also, there was another near miss with a U-2 got shot down right over Cuba again, taking photographs. So they went crazy on that one. We had on Okinawa, where we had nuclear bombers. We were ready to go with the H-bomb against China because we were going to make it not only Russia, we were going to make it China too. This thing was very serious. Kennedy was scared. And at the last second, I mean, he knew, and Khrushchev knew, they started to communicate. But they didn't have a red phone in those days. They couldn't talk to each other. So they had to go through go-betweens. The go-betweens were crucial. Kennedy knew that he could not control this situation that much longer, that the hardliners would win in the end, that there would be some outbreak that they couldn't stop. Khrushchev knew the same thing. Khrushchev withdrew the missiles. They made a deal. And basically from that moment on, Khrushchev and Kennedy began to thaw. And by 1963, a year later, they're signing the Limited Test Ban Treaty, mm-hmm. which is very interesting because that's the first nuclear test ban treaty we ever have in the nuclear age from 1945 on. It's a significant moment. Plus, there's a lot of other things that go on, an opening to Cuba. Kennedy puts out an order not to withdraw the first 1,000 troops from Vietnam. By the way, Kennedy's never put combat advisors into Vietnam, although the Pentagon wants combat advisors. They want, Vietnam is the next target. If they can't win in Cuba, goddammit, they're going to make a point. They both, it's a very interesting story because it's about militarism and American militarism and how it continues on after Vietnam, which is a disaster for us. We go on right after Vietnam, and by the way, we don't stop. We start building up again right after Vietnam.
Now, it was kind of interesting that, in the portrayal in the documentary that these two world leaders essentially, like you said, thawed. And they kind of realize, like, oh, the entire planet's going to go up in flames if we don't back off a little bit. And at the same time, risking looking weak as leaders for not going in and essentially obliterating each other.
That's always a big thing, isn't it? Khrushchev wrote that famous letter to Kennedy, "Good can come out of this evil." It's a beautiful letter. You should read it. It's in the chapter. And it's in the book, too. But Khrushchev had been through Stalingrad. He'd been a political commissar there. He'd seen the nature of war. He saw how bad it was. The Soviet Union was devastated by the war. They both were mature men. Kennedy had been in World War II. He'd been a PT hero, PT 109 type hero. He saved a man drowning. He saved men drowning. He had a backbone. He wasn't like Obama. He was a guy who could stand up to the military. He thought the generals were stupid. And after the Bay of Pigs, he fired Dulles, the head of the CIA, and he made comments about the Joint Chiefs, that these people were really from the Stone Age. He had people like Curtis LeMay on his Air Force Chief of Staff, Arleigh Burke, Lemnitzer. These people were not the brightest people. They were geared for war. They were World War II people who were arrogant, and they thought that they could take the Soviets. And they probably could have at that point, but it would have been a disaster for us. The world would have probably never, it wouldn't be the world we know today.
How do you know when
maybe the right wingers in America would like it this way, but I don't think you and I would be sitting here quite so civilized.
How do you know when you're making a 10-part documentary series, this 12-part documentary series, The Untold History of the United States, how do you get to as much of what you believe the truth to be as possible? How do you find out when you have, you know, decades of stories and hearsay, and how do you get to the nature of what you believe to be true?
That's what age is about. That's the only thing I can recommend about getting older is you get wiser. I've been through so much of the tyranny of now, the details of the news and all the crises that come and go. I've been reading the newspaper since the 1950s, and over time I think you get a little bit more sagacious about things. About every crisis is not the crisis it's perceived. All the events that happen on a daily basis are, there's no, where is the pattern? What is going on underneath this? Don't buy all the news that you hear all the time. And I haven't. But, you know, in 2008, after two terms of George Bush, which was a nightmare for me as a veteran, because we were back in Iraq fighting a war that was unnecessary. And I think Afghanistan was overdone the way we did it. So at that point, Peter Kuznick is a historian at American University. I've known him for 20 years. We combined our forces as a dramatist and as a historian to write this book and make this series. And in those 5 years, I really did it was like going back to school and getting a master's or a PhD in history. For me, I learned a lot. I mean, I knew about various events like the Kennedy assassination and Nixon administration, what I'd seen and heard, the Bush administration. But I'm saying putting it all together and looking for a pattern. Where did we become this country? Certainly it accelerates after World War II. We become a national security state. There's no question. And we hyped the fear. We hyped the fear in the people. We built up our budgets. And by the time the Soviet Union went away as a so-called threat in 1991, did we stop? Did we change? Did we go back? No. We kept going. By 1992, we were in Iraq. We sent 500,000 men to Saudi Arabia, which was a huge mistake because we trumped up this threat from Hussein as the new Hitler. He invaded Kuwait, and we made out of it like the beginning of World War II, literally, if you go back to those days in the PR. And we sent 500,000 men there, and that, of course, caused a whole dislocation, again, of our economy as well as of the Middle East. So one thing leads to another, and when Al-Qaeda attacks us in 2001, do you remember one of their reasons for attacking us? They stated it very clearly, was our putting troops in the Holy Land, Mecca, in Saudi Arabia. Those 500,000 troops bothered them no end, as well as our relationship with Israel. So, I mean, all these things they don't come out of nowhere. They're always like there's a cause and effect, and that's what we were looking for in our history, looking for patterns, cause, effect. Why do people do these things?
Now, and what I've seen from stuff online, when people sort of challenge you to be when they say, oh, you're the conspiracy guy, you're like, no, I'm not. I'm a storyteller. I'm trying to get to the truth, and I'm trying to tell a story. Yeah.
Well, there's a difference between my movies, because my movies I have to dramatize.
Of course.
But I am very faithful to my research. I try to do the best I can. But you make a JFK movie about the assassination, you're going to combine a hell of a lot of material into 3 hours.
Sure.
And as well as combine characters. But when I'm doing a documentary like Untold History of the United States, I'm a documentarian in that regard. Everything is fact-checked. We did 3 fact-checks on that. Showtime, CBS Legal, as well as our own fact-check. We had to rewrite so many things because so many things you think are accurate or not, you have to check and double check. So that Untold History is documentary, classic documentary. We have opinions in them, but you can see the difference between the opinion and the fact.
Mm-hmm.
So when we get to the Kennedy assassination, we don't talk about it because it's just, there's so much, we can talk about that separately, but we can't prove it.
Right.
And everything has to be proven in a documentary. So we say, we give you all the reasons of what's the difference between Kennedy and Eisenhower and what's the difference between Kennedy and Johnson. And you can figure out the pieces yourself if you've got any brains. There's a huge difference. And when I grew up, they told us that Johnson was essentially the continuation of Kennedy. That's not true. And that's the point we have to make, and that's why we do it, these kind of things. So we stay out of the assassination, but by the time we get to Dallas, I think you can make up your own mind.
Right, about what's going on. So, yeah.
So see the movie and then see the see Chapter 6, because it's a great chapter. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah, Chapter 6. That's the one I watched, the blue, the,
JFK
I saw it on
the
Blu-ray.
Why do we say JFK to the brink? Because John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State in the Eisenhower administration, was a very powerful man. He was almost they called him the Jekyll and Hyde. Eisenhower was always the grandfather type, and Dulles was this very, very hardcore Secretary of State. And he believed in rolling back the Soviet Union, rolling back, not just containment. And part of that policy was what he called brinksmanship, which is his policy, which is taking things to the brink. And why? Because we had the nuclear threat. We used to use a nuclear threat 5 or 6 times during the Eisenhower administration, like a gun to the head. Make them give in. So it was very dangerous what he did, because it brought the world to the brink of destruction by 1962. Literally, Dulles is responsible for this behavior that we see in the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA. And his brother, of course, Allen Dulles, ran the CIA, had carte blanche for some 10 years, intervened in every third world country. Literally, we became an empire, an interventionist empire. We led coup d'etats in Iran, do you remember, in 1954-3, and in Guatemala in 54. We also tried to undermine the Indonesian regime in 1956-7. Amazing story. We denied it, but our CIA pilots were shot down there. They were imprisoned. It was embarrassing. We were involved in Angola in Belgian Congo against Patrice Lumumba, who was assassinated by the Belgians, but we tried to poison him first. I mean, we were no good. And in Vietnam, we backed the French. We paid for 85% of their war. Had a lot to do with postponing the elections of 1955, which would maybe have solved the issue in Vietnam. We did not want Ho Chi Minh to win. We were bad guys all over the world. Now, the Russians did bad things, too, in Hungary and various countries, in Czechoslovakia. But I'm saying during the 50s, if you look at the scorecard and keep track of who's doing what, we come out as the heavies.
Do you prefer documentarian or dramatist?
I would never do a documentary again. That took me 5 years. And it's hard to make, it's hard to make a living doing it. It was a work of love, and it made me better. It refreshed me. It gives me more strength. But I really am a storyteller. I'd like to go back and do a drama.
Yeah. So when you sit down and, when you tackle something like JFK or Nixon or W or Kovic, like, what is it that you want the takeaway to be? Do you want people to kind of make up their own minds, or do you?
I don't think about that. That's when I go on a show, they say, well, what's your message? Why don't I send you, hold it up on a piece of cardboard? No, I'm into it because of the process. I think that when I do a Ron Kovic story, I walk in his shoes as I walked in the shoes of Nixon, which was an amazing experience because I didn't admire Nixon. I disliked him. But a dramatist doesn't take sides. You walk in the shoes of the person. Why would I make a movie about W. Bush, who I think was a moron? I think he was a dumb man with a limited vision. I know you just probably disagree with his career there. But, why would I make a movie about somebody I don't admire? Because I'm trying to understand. You understand? I put myself in his shoes, and many people faulted me for making him too sympathetic. If you remember, Josh Brolin was somewhat criticized for not being hard enough on Bush. So you can't win. But that's what a dramatist does. You live the story you're telling. So sometimes you do a person like a Nixon or a Bush, and sometimes you do a Kovic or a Lely Hayslip, who was a female Vietnamese female peasant who managed in the heaven and earth to live on both sides of the war. I learned something about life, a truth. My crime movies, Natural Born Killers, U-Turn, and Savages, I lumped them as one, although they were at different times in my life. But in a certain way, that's my anarchic side. There's something I learned about myself by acting that out. If I hadn't done those three movies, I don't think I would be the same person.
Do you think Natural Born Killers was prophetic in the sense that it almost sort of predicted, like, social media and the idea of elevating this insane behavior for people to consume, like,
as
fast
I remember,
food?
The Natural Born, each film has its own origin, and I kept a diary of all these years, so I know I'd have to go back and read it. But as I remember, the Natural Born Killers came out of a sense of disgust in 1990s, early 90s, after the JFK thing. I'd been so trashed by so much press and so much silliness and tabloid. And I felt this madness coming on American society of television with the O.J. Simpson trial as a case in point. I mean, it's a murder. It's certainly sensational. But it was so much was made out of it. It distracted society for people were not paying attention to more important things, and they became enamored of this trial, and it became the news, and it drove like a probably $10 billion cycle through television of advertising. You have to realize how much people invest in them. The capitalist system believes in sensationalism and violence as a means to an end, to get money, to create interest, to spark something. So they made a fortune off O.J. Simpson, as they made off every murder trial at that point. There was a bunch of murder trials. You don't even know, a woman cut off her husband's penis. There was all they made the big things out of everything, and that was front page news. You know, an ice skater pushed another ice skater. You know, it gets silly, and our society got very silly in the 90s. And that's what Natural Born Killers was about two freaked out teenagers who have a horrible existence. Their father is abusive. Their mother is very passive. And they fall in love. They go on a rampage because all they know is violence. But we see a society around them that is even sicker than they are. We see a prison warden. We see a cop. We see a media that's insane. So it was a satire about our society, and it was misunderstood.
Do you feel like a lot of your characters are these sort of bigger-than-life characters that are in this world around them that's utterly insane? I mean, even going back to, like, movies that you wrote, like Scarface or Conan, like, do you feel like that there are – do you see a similar pattern in all of these characters and these
well,
kinds
actually,
of
Scarface,
stories?
I remember my political instincts were not as developed back then because I was still figuring out my way. But I remember Scarface was very much – the idea, although he was a scumbag, he was a gangster, and he was based on the old film, was that he was also an American immigrant who dreamed a big dream, which is the American dream, which is what? Money, power, and sex. Those were the three things in his coordinates. And although he was awful to people, he never killed anybody without reason in the movie. We show that kind of clearly, that everyone he kills is basically a gangster. And then later in the movie, when he becomes insane with paranoia, no matter how disfigured he becomes with cocaine usage and stuff, he's unable to kill the child and the wife of the diplomat he's assigned to kill by the cartel in the South America. In other words, he has some resident integrity feeling. And also when his sister, of course, you know, the whole thing with his sister and his friend is also the part of that resident integrity that he has.
Well, then, do you, as a dramatist, is that part of your goal?
In other words, no matter how bad you are, no matter how awful
the situation,
there's
still a human piece of you.
There is something human left in Tony Montana, in my mind. Now, I didn't direct the movie, but that's the way I wrote it. Conan the Barbarian was changed quite, is altered quite a bit. The script is fascinating, and would have cost a lot more money. And I think it would have ended up as a 12 part series. It would have made the producers a lot more money, but they went the other way. They short-circuited it. It ended in two films.
Right. So when you said that, because I watched an interview online that you did with your son, actually. And you were talking about how JFK, you said after JFK, you essentially said there was a shitstorm, and then, you know, people said you were crazy or people gave you shit. And so what exactly happened, and then when did it happen in that process?
Well, no, JFK was, I mean, I also was got a lot of praise. It got 8 Oscar nominations.
Well, yeah, of course.
And it won 2 for editing and for cinematography. You know, the film was significant, and it led to the JFK Act, which was passed, which allowed for an expansion on the records of the records and an investigation of more records up until 1998. They did a pretty interesting job, and it revealed a lot of new stuff. Of course, some records are still being held. We found that out, too. But the point was that it did lead to some productive results, and it woke people up again to what they felt outrage about, that this was something crooked about this murder. I still maintain that there is very much so, very crooked murder. But we can get into that in another question. But my life changed with that movie because I was very hot off of Born on the 4th of July and Platoon and Wall Street and Doors. And in a sense, it crossed a line because filmmakers didn't go into these arenas with such detail. We had done a lot of research. We had experts with us, forensic experts, photography experts, ballistics experts. I mean, we had good people working on the film who'd been involved in the JFK critical community for years. It wasn't like we went into this blind, but I didn't know that there was so much, we'd hit such a nerve until the second week of shooting, when the Washington Post sent a reporter down to Dealey Plaza. We were shooting the assassination, and there was a guy there, and we didn't know who he was. And next thing we know, we pop up in the Sunday pages of the Washington Post, second week, third week of shooting, vivisecting us with off an old script that he had drafted. I think we were on our eighth or ninth draft, and he was working off the second draft. So he was pointing up all the things that were wrong in the script. Before the movie had been seen, I think that was really unfair. We called the Post, and we got into a war with them. And it was a war all the way through. It was a war for getting our point of view across on paper, not just on film. It's a war you end up losing against the mainstream media. Newsweek had a cover before we came out saying, "Don't believe this film." Literally,
oh, wow.
You know, that kind of war. So it was very frustrating. And obviously, I went on television for almost 6 months after the film was released to defend my honor and defend the reputation of the film. Like, my attitude is, like, I'm not just a filmmaker who's making just another movie. No, this is, I believe this. I believe this happened. And I believe our country was robbed. And I think Kennedy was killed by more than one gunman.
And so you feel like, at the time, it's so unfortunate that there wasn't, that you didn't have outlets like the social media outlets today where you could reach out to people directly and go, hey, here's what I mean, you basically were, if you're saying that the press was against you, you were having
I
to
didn't
use
say all the press.
But some of the press. But
most
you were
of the
you were,
mainstream
you were,
press, yes.
You were still having to use the mainstream press to get your
yeah.
opinion out, but it wasn't getting
the
out
film
necessarily
spoke
in the way.
For itself. That's all I can say. This film spoke for itself, and many reviewers were kind to it. Roger Ebert, who was a big reviewer, said that I don't know all the facts of the case, but I know there's something right about it. He catches the mood. He catches the atmosphere. There's something that's inherently right about this movie, which is as good a compliment as you can get. But you know, too many of the critics thought that they were experts on the JFK issue. They should not have. I don't think they should have gone there, because I think, for example, the New York Times has always been very critical of any book or commentary or document. They won't even run a review generally of a book that's critical of the Warren Commission. It's a very strange story. It goes on for years. So does the Washington Post. But meanwhile, the New York Times gave us a lousy review. You know, that kind of thing. But people went. It was like Platoon. They couldn't be stopped. They were curious because there was heat. There was a heat about the film, okay? So the film spoke for itself, and I still think it does. And I'm very proud of the film. There's nothing wrong in the film. It's got a solid case. The shooting, the evidence, the window, the Dealey Plaza sequences, the Garrison case, although he had a weak case, we showed that it was a weak case on film. He admitted it on film. So it wasn't like we were building up Garrison into be something he was not. He was a brave man because he brought into the light of day the operations of a covert branch of the U.S. government. That's what he was suggesting. And even to this day, you know as well as I do, even with all your media, the Julian Assanges and the Bradley Mannings and the Snowdens, they're still out of luck in our society. They're still the anti-heroes, right? I mean, they haven't improved in our society. These people Snowden is stuck in another country. He's exiled. These people can't do what Garrison did. Garrison brought the trial, was vilified, marginalized, ridiculed. He went through hell. I knew the man. But Snowden is going through the same thing. But maybe now, because you see Snowden, maybe your generation can understand what Garrison went through. It's very hard to prove these things when the government doesn't. Snowden had the documentation, thank God. But without the documentation, he would have been treated, he would probably have been arrested, and he ran away before he could be arrested.
Right. So when you look back and watch JFK, which, by the way, they're releasing in theaters again because it's the 50th anniversary.
Now, yes.
And I know that I think I have the dates here, but I think on the 17th and the 20th.
It's a Sunday showing in various cities. Here in L.A., it's 1 week until next Friday. And it's from this week. It's this week. I'm going to do a Tuesday Q&A at the Cinerama Dome.
Okay.
And in New York, it's in one theater. In Washington, in Georgetown, one theater. And then it hits on Sundays, two different Sundays, I believe. 11th, you said 17th and 24th?
Yeah, I think the 17th and the 20th, I believe, are the
They'll
dates.
Be in a lot of different theaters all around the country, but only on a one-show, two-show basis.
It is when you look back at the movie, it is like a museum of every actor at the time.
Well, we're bringing out a Blu-ray, a new edition, 50th anniversary edition, with Chapter 6 in it. With a lot of new documentaries and PT 109, the film about Kennedy, made by Cliff Robertson in 1950s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that'll come out. It's coming out in November.
It's coming out tomorrow. So by the time this posts, it'll be out. Yeah, it'll already be out.
Coming out tomorrow.
What have we learned in the last 50 years? Have we learned anything? Are we closer? Are there things that you thought when you made JFK that you've learned new information or changed your mind about?
We know now, for example, the JFK Act led to the Assassination Records Review Board, and they took 4 million pages of documents, 4 million pages of documents to go through. So there's a lot of detailed stuff that. One thing we know is that the CIA, for example, was very intimate with Oswald from 59 to 63. In the Warren Commission, it said the CIA had a routine and sporadic involvement with Oswald. But we now know that there's more there, and we know more about the people who were involved with him. Those files, by the way, were not released in the 90s, as was requested by the Assassination Records Review Board. They were not released. So there's about 1,100 documents. Jefferson Morley, who used to work for the Post and has now gone rogue, has gone with his own blog, JFK Acts. He has a JFKActs.org, which is a very good organization on paper. It's a website, rather. Morley has, through the National Archives, has found some of the individuals who he would like to know more about and has asked for it, but he's not going to get it from the CIA. These would involve James Angleton, who was a chief of counterintelligence of the CIA. James Angleton, very famous character. Richard Helms, who was deputy director. He attacked our film. George Gianides, the Miami bureau chief. David Phillips, the Mexico City bureau chief. Very interesting figure. Comes up again and again. E. Howard Hunt on a lower level, and David Morales, both of whom late in their lives seemed to implicate themselves in the assassination. Hunt told his son he was there that day, he was involved. I mean, there's been a lot of those kind of things. We need to get the files on those people because they're all around the case. William Harvey's another one. Morley's done a good job, but everyone's working on this from different angles. Of course, the big thing is the autopsy. That was the biggest medical fraud of all, that the autopsy, the way it worked out. The case in our film is pretty much the case. It holds up. Kennedy was shot from two sides. It was because you have a shot to the neck from the front and you have a kill shot. Frame 313 of the Zapruder film takes him at the right temple, blows out the back of his skull. Witnesses all over the place at Parkland and at Bethesda see the skull, the cerebellum, comes out. There's hardly any brain left. In the autopsy photos, in the autopsy that's presented, he still has a brain that weighs as much as when he got shot. So it doesn't make any sense what happened. The body disappeared for a while. There was the photographer who was there that day who shot the photos does not recognize the photos that were presented by the autopsy. So we have this kind of weird stuff that happens because the body disappeared for a while. Went to Washington. The point that you have to keep in mind is back and to the left, back and to the left. When you're in infantry, you take a shot at somebody. You saw the police chief in Vietnam who shot the guy.
Yeah.
The guy falls a certain way. You shoot somebody in the head, he goes back and to the left. And we showed that in the film. It's in the Zapruder film that was done that day. Now, you can argue all you want that you can go to the front, this, that. And you can come up with all the fancy arguments, but an infantry soldier will tell you the truth. So you shoot a man, he goes the way of the shot. That's what Kennedy did. He was shot from the front. The first shot in the throat and the fourth or the fifth shot up here. There's a shot in the back that hits him and a separate shot that hits Connolly. That indicates at least four bullets, not three. Connolly was not hit at the same time as Kennedy from the back. You don't see a reaction in the film from Connolly at the same time as Kennedy. And there's also a missing shot that goes to James Teague, who was hit at the underpass. He had a graze on his cheek. So there's at least five shots, probably six, because some people believe that Connolly was shot twice. There was the magic bullet that the Warren Commission invented, the magic bullet, the single bullet theory by Arlen Specter. He was an evil fucker who was a lawyer. He was a lawyer who worked for the Warren Commission, and he guided the witnesses. He guided the autopsy chief. Awful man. But anyway, he came up with a bullet that goes through two hard bones and creates seven wounds in Kennedy and Connolly. He calls that and then it comes out pristine. They call it the pristine bullet. It's a joke. But that becomes, and they actually went with that. And that's the weakest thing in the whole Warren Commission is the pristine bullet, the single bullet theory. But on top of that, you have this the Zapruder film that shows you the front, the shot from the front that hits him. So you have two big things staring at you. That's evidence.
Is there any part of you that's sort of like just
even if you, I don't believe Oswald did it. No, because I have, there's another story on Oswald. But the thing is that even if it was Oswald on the sixth floor window shooting it with a Mannlicher Carcana, which is the worst weapon in World War II, she could probably tell you that it's a piece of shit weapon. And it's a bolt action. It's a bolt action. You have to make. Plus, you miss your first shot, and then you hit your other. Your Kennedy's receding from you in a car through a tree. And why don't you take the shot when he's coming towards you? I don't know, but assume that you let him make the curve and you go down away from you. Then you miss the first shot. Then you hit him with the last two, all in within 6 seconds. It's crazy. The weapon was not even used, and they never made the print contact. He never had a paraffin test. There's no chain of evidence on the weapon itself. Plus, they found other rifles that day. The Mauser, they found other types of shells. It was a botched case. It wasn't that well done.
Are you tired of sort of being the go-to guy with this
no,
stuff?
No, I'm not the go-to guy. I'm going to put. If you're serious, I'll get you three or four guys. Who are going to sit here and we'll take you through this step by step.
Well, I just mean
who
like
are professionals.
As an
amateur,
as a writer director, are you? Is there any party that's like, I just want to write about fictional people?
Yeah,
again.
Yeah. I do, but this pisses me off. You got to understand. They treat us like we're stupid. The Warren Committee, the arrogance of government power, and they didn't make such a. They weren't that smart. I think they're shocked. You know, by the way, life goes on, technology goes on. I think we could. Anyway, let's go on.
No. It's good. I mean, let's listen. This is something that you're passionate about, and it's fascinating. You know, unfortunately, I don't have enough information. Like, I'm hearing everything you're saying, and I'm going, uh-huh. Like, I don't know.
Well, just remember, people will argue with you and all this. He was shot from two sides. Remember, that's the most important thing. He was shot from two sides. He was not shot from one side. He was shot from the back and the front. That means there has to be another gunman. That gunman, if you stand in Dealey Plaza, has to be at defense. That's the kill shot. You see him coming towards you. It's a beautiful shot. You can easily get him. A good marksman can. Oswald was not a good marksman, but that's... Just remember, shot from two sides and back and to the left, back and to the left. Those are your two basic things. And you can't... And we'll go to court on that. We'll fight in a trial on that. We can get our experts from both sides, and I think you'll believe our side when we're done.
Well, you also... You also seem to have a sense of humor about. I mean, I remember seeing you in Dave, where this is like the shot. This like the yeah. This footage of you in the background. Yeah. And you can see that he's clearly not the same guy.
I feel like the guy from Dave sometimes. Wasn't he the only guy who was right in the end?
He was right. Yeah, he was right. But then you also did a series in the early 90s, right? What was it? Palms.
Palms.
Yes, where they're interviewing you in the background, and it's like years in the future. And they're like, so is it satisfying to know that you were right about everything?
I had gray hair. I'm right about these 12 chapters too. I hope you get our history, because that's the best history of America, modern America, you're going to find in one place. And it's not our work as historians. We build on the shoulders of other people. Cold War revisionists have provided this history. I'm not an original researcher. I'm only a dramatist working with a historian who's working on the shoulders of like six or seven major historians from the 1950s and 60s who've done this questioning of our history.
Yeah. So as a dramatist, where is the line between representing something as fact, but then also you know, having to put an artistic spin on it?
That's in the film, not in the documentary.
Not in the documentary.
No, in the film. No, I would always, you say based on a life or... based on, or this is a representation. You're taking many different witnesses, and you're making maybe one or two witnesses for dramatic length. You're having 17 incidents happen to a person, or 25 incidents, and you make them into five. You know, you have to find a way to make it a story that transcends. You know,
well, every fucking movie now, it's just like.
But no, I don't lie. If I know something is wrong, I won't do it. I won't put it in the movie.
Definitely
it.
Not lying.
Some
but
filmmakers will, and they'll say it's a movie. Well, I mean, Osama bin Laden story, whatever this bin Laden, bin zero, whatever it was, zero bin 30. You know,
Zero Dark 30.
They would have you believe that the torture led to the. Torture in some way led to the execution of the revenge we took on bin Laden, correct? I don't believe that. I don't think he should have had that in. I think torture, it demeans us as a country. And I don't think we used it, because I think what we do with terrorists is we find them. We find them through informants, for the most part, intelligence, and we ad hoc specific activity. Probably Bin Laden would have been found because somebody gave him up, because there was a lot of money involved. There was a lot of pressure that way. Generally, the gangsters and the terrorists are revealed by other people who work with them. It doesn't come from eavesdropping the whole world and trying to find a pin in a haystack. It doesn't work that way.
Do you feel like that because
allow for torture, we allow for international eavesdropping, global architecture, we say we need that to fight terrorists, we're really wrong. We're morally wrong.
So do you feel like do people just contact you all the time and go, hey, Oliver Stone, I have some weird information about something?
Yes, all the time. As a result, I know more than you think. I get a lot of stuff, but some of it is, the thing is, I can't ignore things. I mean, I try to pay attention. It's very hard when you get a lot of stuff, but I always try to have it covered or listened to. I mean, try to be reasonable, because there is stuff out there in the world that is pretty shocking.
So do you feel like someone like Snowden is more patriotic in some cases?
I do. I think he did it out of conscience. No, I believe he's a hero. I've said so publicly.
And what was the response?
I think many people agree with me. I did an NSA PSA, anti-NSA PSA for the ACLU. And for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, I think it's called. We've been on TV. We've stated our views. I totally agree with Glenn Greenwald in his view of government and the wrongness of these measures. As I said, putting out a omniscient 1984 all-seeing state is not a solution. It's a terrifying solution. It scares everybody. A suspect. You too. You too. We're all suspect. Nobody is innocent in this world now, because with this mentality. Bush said it when he. You remember Bush? I don't know if you're young enough or.
Oh yeah, yeah. You mean the first Bush?
The second Bush.
The W. Bush. Yeah.
Do you remember him when he said, "You're either with us or against us"? That was terrifying. All of a sudden, he took 2,000 villains, terrorists, and made them into 60 different countries. And he said, "You're all. If you're not with us, you're against us." That scares me when somebody says that, because I don't know who's. Really, with the power the United States have technologically to destroy people, drones, space weaponry, anything that they would deem a terrorist in the future. I mean, you imagine, you have a sense of history, right? You know,
sure.
The people like who formed totalitarian states like Hitler or Franco or Mussolini would declare terrorists, people inside their state. Anybody who was opposing to their authoritarianism would be called a terrorist. That's a common... It's a common method of operation, M.O.
So what would you do?
So maybe because of your Underground Railroad connections, because you're against the Vietnam or Afghani war, or because you're for Snowden, all of a sudden you're on their web. Maybe they're going to declare you a terrorist.
Did you ever feel like you were in danger?
From them now?
Yeah. Or at any point.
Well, I've thought about it, and so does everybody. Everybody who's got any sense would think about using their iPhone or anything you use. I mean, you're being tracked all the time. If they want, retroactively, I'm not saying they're watching me now, but if they wanted to go back and check my file, and let's say another Bush comes into office, or we have another terrorist incident where everyone goes crazy again, who knows?
What would be your solution? What would be your solution? What would be the first thing you could do if someone said, hey, Oliver Stone, take over the government. What do you do?
I'd declare Monday a holiday.
Okay, that's a good idea. Yeah.
I think that'd
then you
be
get
popular.
A three-day weekend. You
I
get a nice three-day
Monday
weekend.
Every Monday would be a holiday, and yep. I'd say we're going to have a four-day work week, and that's the way it's going to be. Okay.
All right, okay, okay. I'm on board for
then
that.
Then I'd repeal the Patriot Act, and I'd fire the heads of the NSA. And the CIA, and I would start over. And I would get into the Pentagon. That'd be dangerous. Because that's a separate government inside our country.
Wow. Well,
are we over? No, we got to get going to Travis.
You have to go to Travis Smiley.
Anyway, it's very sweet of you to have me.
Oh, it was a great...
Thank you,
this
Monica.
This is a really great...
Pleasure to meet you.
This is really fascinating chat. And it is... I mean, it's... You know, your detail and your knowledge is definitely intimidating. Most of it, I'm just listening.
I thought you were smart.
Yeah!
I thought you read all this stuff. You should watch all 12 chapters.
I definitely will watch all 12. I literally just got it.
If you do, I'll come back.
Yeah, I will.
Because then we can have more of a discussion, and I'd like Monica to be part of the Korean discussion.
Do you have anything to say, Mon? No, she gets embarrassed.
I was in Korea this summer protesting the island. They're building another naval base, South Koreans, on Jeju Island, which is a beautiful island. They're ruining it.
Oh, wow.
It's huge. They're building, it's only 300 miles from Shanghai. It's the anti-China pivot that we're doing.
And so you went there to protest?
Yeah. Yeah. And the Koreans, I went to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Okinawa. Okinawa is another base, full of bases, and it's also got a strange history, World War II. And Korea has been really one of our most important allies. Armed to the teeth. Korea and Japan are armed to the teeth by us, and they're ready for war.
Do you have any opportunities to just have fun and relax?
I love Korea. I love Japan. I love those places. Yeah, I do. I relax.
Okay, good.
I have fun. I have fun. I do. What do you? I look like I don't have fun.
No, it's just because because of the documentary, because of 50th edition.
Yeah, it's
the
too
50th
much work.
Anniversary.
Right now.
It's so serious and so serious and like JFK and. It's
and I'm writing something new, so you know. Yeah. I'm writing a movie, by the way, not a documentary.
Good fictional movie or based on
dramatic
a,
based on sorry
based on a story. That's all right. That's all right. Well, it's good to see you.
All right.
Thanks.
Chris.
And he's at the Oliver Stone on Twitter and the 50th edition of the 50th
and
anniversary.
Facebook too.
And Facebook.
The Oliver
well.
Stone Experience, right?
The Oliver Stone Experience, is that right? So the new edition, the 50th anniversary JFK edition, is out, which is a gorgeous box set. And then also the Untold History of the United States Showtime.
Do you have a men's room here?
Yeah, we do. We do.
Enjoy a burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code NERDIST11. Nerdist and the number 11.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.